every single moment.
In the limelight.
Nationwide, only about 34% of the $45 billion Congress sent to states and cities for rental assistance had been distributed by October 31st, according to data from the U.S. Department of the Treasury. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Sarah Kleiner Ryder. This article is published under the heading Rural America is facing an invisible eviction crisis. Stay tuned for more. About 70 miles northwest of the U.S. capital, in the affluent Virginia countryside and across the state line into West Virginia, there is a house on a hill in a deteriorating neighborhood. Inside sits Melody Schaefer, rubbing her red-rimmed eyes at the dining table. Her husband, Chris Pasco, paces between the dimly lit kitchen and living room. Paint peels from a nearby door frame. Schaefer repeatedly says, when asked where they would go now, that they were about to be evicted. I have no clue. It was the day before Thanksgiving. At the bustling Walmart down the road, shoppers filled their carts with potatoes, stuffing, green beans, and pumpkin pie, oblivious to the scene that had unfolded that morning in Country Courthouse. Jefferson County Magistrate Judge Vicky Dangelo had ruled in favor of three landlords and ordered the tenants living in their homes, including Schaefer and Pasco, to vacate by December 3rd. To wait and do this in the winter time, right before it gets cold, Schaefer trailed off. Statistically speaking, not much is known about evictions that are occurring outside the U.S. urban areas during the COVID-19 pandemic. There is no national system that monitors eviction cases in real time. The largest set of publicly available data is gathered by Princeton Eviction Lab, which is tracking cases in 6 states and 31 cities. Data in those urban areas show mixed trends. In places with few tenant protections, the number of cases is growing up, according to Eviction Lab. But tenants' lawyers in the country's less populated regions say they are also handling more cases now that the federal moratorium on evictions has expired. States like West Virginia, South Dakota, Delaware, and Arkansas have been slow to dole out rental assistance from the federal government, money that's meant to be a levy holding back a flood of evictions. Nationwide, only about 34% of the $45 billion Congress sent to states and cities for rental assistance had been distributed by October 31st, according to data from the U.S. Department of the Treasury. Other pots of money have been slow to be spent too, including $9 billion the Department of Housing and Urban Development sent to states and cities to combat housing-related COVID-19 fallout. Brent Thompson, Executive Director for East River Legal Services, which provides representation to low-income residents in eastern South Dakota, said, "My frustration is widespread. It's just sad when you see a continuing problem day in and day out, and there is only so much you can do for them." Thompson said the biggest hurdle he has faced in South Dakota is lack of information for tenants, many of whom were living in poverty before COVID-19 swept through the state. Thompson said, "We have developed a culture where people don't tend to avail themselves for protections afforded to them. This isn't a new problem. It's a problem that's being magnified by the pandemic and reaching a crisis point because of the pandemic." Back when the federal eviction moratorium was in place, people living in South Dakota tended to simply move elsewhere when their landlords threatened to evict, rather than fight for their right to stay, Thompson said. And many tenants either don't know about the state's $200 million rental assistance allocation from the federal government or haven't been able to access those funds. As of October 31st, only 4% of that money had been distributed to tenants and landlords, according to data from the U.S. Department of the Treasury. A November report from the National Low Income Housing Coalition placed South Dakota and Wyoming last among states for the share of rental assistance they had sent to tenants and landlords. The South Dakota Housing Development Authority, which is administering the state's rental assistance programs, has distributed aid to more than 5,200 households with money from the federal government, said Amanda Weiss-Graham, spokesperson for the agency. The state approved 75% of the completed applications it received. Weiss-Graham noted the need for assistance isn't as acute in South Dakota because the state's businesses weren't forced to close during the pandemic, and residents weren't required to stay home. But Thompson's office saw a 30% jump in eviction cases for 4 months in a row earlier this year, and he said the need for attorneys is growing. Only 8 attorneys cover this 33-county region, which spans 30,000 square miles. His territory is home to a large population of undocumented migrant workers and indigenous people, groups that have historically been exploited by landlords. South Dakota ranks last in terms of access to legal representation, according to the National Center for Access to Justice. In Delaware, landlords have been hesitant to sign up for rental assistance programs, said Dan Atkins, executive director of Community Legal Aid Society Incorporation. Landlords have balked at providing financial records to the state government, and they haven't wanted to give up the right to evict tenants in exchange for receiving rental payments. "You can't drag a horse to water, but you can't make them drink," Atkins said. "We will drag them to the water, but we don't know if they will drink." Many of the lowest income tenants in Delaware don't know about the rental assistance available to them. They don't have reliable access to internet, and some people aren't able to read, Atkins said. "All of this is a challenge when the state requires pages of documentation proving financial hardship. Plus, there is a narrative in the low-income community that no one is going to help," he said. Over 80% of landlords are represented in eviction cases in Delaware, Atkins said, while fewer than 5% of tenants have lawyers by their side. "There is not enough legal aid to go around," Atkins said. "We are starting to see the floodgates open a bit, and we are looking over our shoulder and wondering if it's going to be a big tidal wave soon." As of October 31st, only 10% of Delaware's $200 million allocation in rental assistance had been doled out to tenants and landlords, according to data from the Treasury Department. In Arkansas, state officials were lagging behind most other states for the first 7 months of the Emergency Rental Assistance Program, but they picked up the pace of distributing money in October, Treasury Department data show. Still, that's only used up 22% of the state's $174 million allocation. The public badly needs access to rental assistance funds, said Kendall Levington, housing subject area manager for the Center for Arkansas Legal Services, adding that the state amended its policies to make it easier for tenants to access the aid. He said, "I just hope that it isn't too late for most people." As of October 15th, Levin's office had handled twice as many landlord-tenants cases in 2021 as it did in the same period in 2020. Eviction in Arkansas is uniquely punitive, Levin said. It's the only state in the U.S. that charges tenants with a crime for failing to pay their rent and vacate their home. Nearly 450 people were charged with that misdemeanor crime between March 2020 and November 2021 in Arkansas, according to data from the state's court system. Of those, 133 were found guilty. Back in West Virginia, Schaffer and Pasco went living in a neighborhood littered with rotting tires and stacks of lumber. The house next door was shrouded by dead bodies. As of December 15, they hadn't found a place they could afford to rent, and they were thinking they had have to spend the night outside. They didn't apply for rental assistance because the process would take weeks to complete, and Pasco's income as a handyman in the flooring business had dried up. So had the income of Johnny Harrell, who was in the tree trimming business in nearby Charlestown. Harrell said his employer died and he was suddenly out of work. He said he had never missed a rental payment before, but he could no longer afford to pay $500 a month. His landlord, Alex Salgado, purchased a small building Harrell was living in about 18 months ago. Harrell was the first person he had to evict. Salgado said, "It's a circle, right? I need to get money in so I can pay for the building." Like Schaffer and Pasco, Harrell found out the day before Thanksgiving that he would be evicted by December 3rd. He didn't want to move into his son's home, which was already crowded. The only place he could think to live was inside an old pop-up camper on a nearby campground. It isn't insulated, and the temperatures were already dropping below freezing at night. At the last minute, Harold's relatives helped him rent an apartment in Maryland so he wouldn't have to sleep in the camper. "It felt loosey," Harold said of his experience in the courtroom. "You work all your life and you're fine, and you keep going no matter what happens. And you know what? It was heartbreaking."
From the day he started his presidential campaign, U.S. President Joe Biden told the world that America wants to go back to Iran's nuclear deal. From that day, Israel started to threaten the world that if the US goes back to the deal, it would take matters into its own hands. So as the talks continued between Tehran and the P4 plus one group of countries, Israel's voice of agony grows louder. Israel has launched a pressure campaign to make sure that the countries negotiating with Iran in Vienna do not agree to what Israeli officials call a bad deal, meaning a deal that allows Tehran to make nuclear bombs. The very idea of building a nuclear bomb is totally rejected by the Iranian government. In 2003, Iran's leader issued a fatwa that forbade the production and use of any form of weapon of mass destruction, which includes nuclear weapons. However, accusing Iran of going after the nukes is a strategy Israel uses to legitimize its hostile stance against Iran. The regime has even beefed up its military activities. In November, Israeli, Emirati and Bahraini naval forces, for the first time, rehearsed joint security operations with a US warship. A month earlier, Israel launched a war game at a desert airbase just north of the port city of Eilat, which sent fighter planes from the occupied territories and seven other countries roaring into the skies. Israel also allocated $1.5 billion to prepare the Israeli armed forces for a potential strike against Iran nuclear sites. In fact, there are near daily warnings from Israeli political and military officials as well. In the latest move in a series of threats, Israel's Minister of War Affairs ordered his forces to prepare a military option. Benny Gantz warned the world that Israel would take matters into its own hands if a nuclear agreement did not constrain Iran the way Israel wants it to.
Recently, the Chief of Staff, Aviv Kohavi, said that Israel is preparing to strike Iranian nuclear targets if needed. Are those preparations complete?
They will never complete. Before the only time of completing them will be the time that we will actually conduct them. Till then, we will continue to build them, to improve them. This is something that any military needs to do. We are working on it. We have them in our hands, of course, but we will continue and constantly improving them to the highest professional level possible. The Iranian nuclear aspiration must be stalled. If the world stops them before, it's very much good. But if not, we must stand independently and we must defend ourselves by ourselves.
What Gantz said could be interpreted as a direct threat. However, there are multiple military experts in and outside Israel who believe Gantz's statement was nothing but an empty threat. Several current and former senior Israeli military officials and experts say that Israel lacks the ability to attack Iran. Military experts say Tel Aviv can't pull off an assault that could destroy or even significantly delay Iran's nuclear program, at least not anytime soon. Now, one might ask why carrying out an assault on Iran would be impossible, given the fact that Israel has the latest military weaponry, fighter jets, and support of the United States. True, Israel has a long history when it comes to air attacks, but it won't be as easy as it was when it bombed Egypt, Gaza, Iraq, Lebanon, Sudan, Tunisia, and Syria. Not easy, at least, without potentially catastrophic consequences. To be sure, one could not compare Israel's bombing of such facilities in Iran to its air attacks against Iraq's Osirak reactor in 1981 or Syria's Al-Kubar facility in 2007. Relek Shafir, a retired Israeli Air Force general who was a pilot in a 1981 strike on an Iraqi nuclear facility, said, "Bombing Iran's nuclear facility is almost impossible." Iran has dozens of nuclear sites, some deep underground, that would be hard for Israeli bombs to quickly penetrate and destroy. The fact is, the Israeli Air Force does not have warplanes large enough to carry such large bombs, so the more protected sites would have to be struck repeatedly with less effective missiles, a process that might take days or even weeks. The other obstacle is geography. If Israel decides to carry out strikes on Iran, its warplanes must fly over 3,000 kilometers to get to Iran. This would cause fuel shortages as the planes have to fly the same amount to go back to Israel. Israel has already ordered jets that can make such flights at a cost of $2.4 billion, but the aircraft are backordered and Israel is unlikely to receive even one before late 2024. There's also the fear of retaliation. Naturally, if Iran gets attacked, it will respond vehemently. Some Israeli planes would almost certainly be lost during the sorties. Their pilots would be killed or taken prisoner, and such losses would have huge consequences for Israel. Let's not forget that Iran is a country of nearly 86 million people, with the potential ability to mobilize its networks all over the Middle East to retaliate. From Lebanon to Palestine and Syria, pro-Iranian forces surrounding Israel could make the regime pay a huge price for any attack. Israel's famous missile system is no good for such a confrontation either. The Iron Dome was never tested in a real battle. It only intercepted man-made Gazan rockets, not real missiles or rockets. It's not even capable of intercepting those handcrafted missiles coming from Gaza. So, if a war erupts, it is safe to say that the Iron Dome can't be much of a help to Israelis. In the meantime, Iran has a formidable missile arsenal of its own capable of precision strikes, which can easily respond to an Israeli bombing of its nuclear sites by going after softer targets.
They always shoot at Israel rockets, but in 2004 or 5, people start to get killed. Make me very annoyed that we don't have a solution. And also, I remember even 91, when Iraq shoot missiles in Israel, we have no solution. You know, everything was... Tel Aviv was empty. they shoot around Tel Aviv. And I decided that we have to do something. Although nothing had been done around the world, and everybody said it cannot be done.
One doesn't need to be a general or a strategist to find out that the declarations by the Israeli officials about Israel's readiness for a military strike are empty and pointless rhetoric. All you need is to look at the past few decades. Since January 1995, Israel has been saying that Iran is much closer to producing nuclear weapons than previously thought and could be less than 5 years away from having an atomic bomb. 27 years later, Israel continues threatening to bomb Iranian nuclear facilities. And yet nothing. It's quite clear. Israel is just playing pretend.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
in the limelight.
Pediatric units in hospitals in New York, Pennsylvania, Ohio, and Texas have been hit hard. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Fast-Spreading Omicron Variant Drives Up Pediatric Hospitalizations in Parts of U.S. Stay tuned for more. With the fast-spreading Omicron variant now driving new COVID-19 cases up in the United States, public health officials are warning that just as South Africa did in early December, the country is seeing a surge in pediatric hospitalizations related to the disease. The New York Department of Health reported recently that COVID-19 hospitalizations among children under the age of 18 began increasing fourfold the week of December 5th through the current week. No child between the ages of 5 and 11 who was admitted to a hospital with COVID-19 over that period was vaccinated, the department said, and only a third of the children over 11 had received a vaccine. With children under age 5 ineligible for vaccination, officials warned families in New York that the best protection for very young children is to ensure all those around them are fully protected through vaccination, boosters, proper mask wearing, crowd avoidance, and testing. Along with New York, Ohio, Texas, and Pennsylvania have been hit hard by pediatric hospitalizations. Nationwide, about 800 new hospital admissions of children have been reported every day for the past 3 days. Nearly 2,000 pediatric patients with confirmed or suspected COVID-19 cases were hospitalized nationally recently, a 31% increase over 10 days, according to the Washington Post. Data out of the UK also showed that, as of December 19th, hospital admissions were at 3.64 per 100,000 for children up to the age of 4, three times the rate of children ages 5 to 14 who are eligible for vaccination. The data follows reports from South Africa earlier this month, which showed that in Gauteng province, as of the first week in December, patients under the age of 5 were the second largest group being admitted to hospitals, after patients over the age of 60. As the Post reported recently, South Africa's wave of infections from the Omicron variant appears to be waning, giving some people hope, to public health experts elsewhere. Among children in the U.S., the vast majority of cases so far have been mild and look a lot like the common cold, reported Washington Post. In the Allentown, Bethlehem area of eastern Pennsylvania, Lehigh Valley Health Network pediatrics chair Dr. Nathan Hangstorm told the Washington Post that hospitalizations of children are double what they were at the previous peak last winter and the highest of the pandemic, but they still represent a small fraction of all those infected. Scientists at the University of Texas released a report recently predicting that Omicron cases in the United States will likely peak in late January through early February the daily cases slowing down by March. Doc Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing The House on Cocoa Road, directed by Damani Baker. And joining me in the studio, we have Mike McCahill, who is a film and television critic for The Telegraph, The Guardian, and many others. And alongside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, The House on Cocoa Road is the story of director Damani Baker's family, particularly about his mother's story, Fanny Houghton, who moved her children from Oakland, California, to participate in the Grenada Revolution, only to find her family in harm's way of a US military invasion. This film also sheds light on the history of black power movements and their struggle for racial equality.
I call the United States home, but this country has a painful legacy of violence that we still struggle to confront.
I think we always have to find something that holds a promise, and that way we look toward the future.
You're committed to humanity, to making the world a better place. You know, not just for your family, but everybody's family. We were trying to make sense of this world.
One of the most important things that has to be done in the process of carrying out a revolutionary struggle is to merge the personal with the political, where they're no longer separate.
You have this situation where we are trying to build a new society.
Grenada is the southernmost of the Windward Islands in the West Indies.
Here's our revolutionary government right here in our own hemisphere.
It was a utopia.
And the next thing I knew, she was packing you all up.
Grenada, we were told, was a friendly island paradise for tourism. Well, it wasn't. It was a Soviet Cuban colony being readied as a major military bastion to export terror and undermine democracy.
I took my young children out of my country to come here to help this country. I left in pain. This is the first time I've been back, so you've got to be very sensitive.
I remember you asking me as the bombs dropped and the island shook. You said this must be what they call war.
There is a freedom tide rising in our hemisphere. The spirit of democracy is assuming its rightful role as the great unifier of the people.
They're shooting! They're shooting!
My mother always said that this is not the way things are supposed to be. And if we work towards change, conditions will become different.
Long live peace in our Americas and in the world. Forward ever, backward never.
First of all, a very warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for joining the show. Now, this documentary gives you an insightful and historical look at race relations in the US and also offers an alternative look at the US-led invasion of Grenada, but from a black perspective. And Mike, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on this film?
I think it's a very strong film. It's a very engaging film. I think what it does particularly well, there's a clip very early on where Angela Davis, the great black activist, is saying, we need to make the personal political. And this is exactly what this film does. It starts with this opening montage of footage from various tapes that Damani Baker, the director, has found in, I think, the garage of his mother when he was moving her house, was moving house. Yeah, and you know, so you've got footage from, you know, 83, 99, 2015, all spliced together. And you get a sense of a young man, young filmmaker, piecing these disparate frames and images together, trying to work out what they represent. But it does so in a way that's incredibly casual. It doesn't feel like a serious history lesson. It feels like you've been invited over to someone's house on a Sunday morning. They're telling you about their family history over coffee and cake. It's sort of deceptively casual, but it does build to a much bigger picture of American life, and Black American life in particular.
And Lee, if I could turn to you now, why is it important to revisit these topics? And we see like a trove of sort of documentaries coming out about Black Power movements, and we've covered quite a few on this show with the Black Panther Party and so forth. What relevance does it have today?
Yeah, it's great relevance, and I think when you look at the historical film that we have, particularly with films like this, it's surprising how much contemporary resonance it has with the situation of African-American communities today in America. But it also speaks, I think, that film to a broader narrative. And it's this perpetual search within the African diaspora for that home, that place, that belonging. And wherever it is, from wherever our particular roots are, we have a deep need to be reconnected. And I think that what you're looking at is African-Americans seeking to escape the predations of Jim Crow, you know, racism and its legacies in America, going to Grenada and then finding themselves at the end of an imperialist gun. And I thought that was a powerful narrative. You've sought to escape racism, but actually you've ended up in a place where American imperialism has rolled up on the Grenadian shores with devastating consequences. And I also think the narrative about Black women's leadership role in having to make decisions about their family, where they live, what quality of life they will like, those are the kind of conversations that I think are, you know, very deep within Black communities of, can we survive here? Will we prosper here? Will our children be treated equally?
That's a very important point to make, and this documentary certainly raises all those issues. It's also a very political film, as you alluded to also. I just want to talk a little bit now about the politics of the film before we move on. So on the one hand, Mike, the official US narrative of the invasion of Grenada was that Grenada's government was working with so-called communist Cuba and wanted to make a base there. And Ronald Reagan, the president at the time, quote, said it was necessary to bring the spirit of freedom and to Grenada in the form of a military strike. But of course, this documentary goes against this narrative, doesn't it, and offers a different perspective.
It does. I think it, what it succeeds in doing is presenting this counterpoint, because Damani Baker realizes that when the family moves away from Grenada, goes back to the USA, the image that he sees of Grenada in American media is very different from the image that he saw growing up. And, you know, you're getting the sense that American news media presented Ronald Reagan as this great liberator. You know, he went into Grenada and sorted the situation out, and all of a sudden it's much better for him doing that. And actually, Damani Baker, what he's done by making this film and piecing all these individual pieces of footage together that have been taken over the decades, what he's done is he's actually presented a very convincing counter-image to that claim, and the counter-image to what was the dominant image in American media at the time.
And I did a bit of more research actually on this topic, because I found it really interesting the way this documentary brought it up. And it was reported that a senior British officer who watched the Grenada invasion from Barbados, Major Mark Adkin, he wrote afterward, quote, that it was launched because of the intense desire of the president and his advisers to raise U.S. prestige, particularly at home and in the armed forces, where morale and self-respect had fallen substantially since the Vietnam War. Lee, do you think that this was the real reason then behind the invasion?
Well, yeah, there's nothing like crushing a little country to, reinforce one's flagging self-esteem. So that's a narrative we've seen in world politics. But I also think that the you've got to remember that, you know, with Norman Manley in Jamaica at the time, that there was a very much sense that there might be a domino effect in relation to socialism, communism in the region.
The U.S. perceived this as a threat?
The U.S. perceived this as a very real threat that could see a swathe of Caribbean islands really moving to the left, not far from their coast. And so a combination of hubris, arrogance, imperialism, and real genuine fear, I think, of the extent to which the Caribbean could be involved, fueled American ambition to try and stamp out any nascent light of an alternative socialist agenda in the reader.
Hello, my name is Damani Baker. I am the director of The House on Cocoa Road, a documentary about my mother. My mom moved my sister and I from Oakland, California, where I was born and raised, to take part in the Grenada Revolution. So this film was about how we ended up in Grenada in the first place, how we ended up in a country that eventually would be invaded by the United States as my family hid under a bed when bombs dropped all around us. In order to understand that, I had to go back and retrace my mother's history, her story. Her story of having parents who were part of the Great Migration West, great-grandparents who were sharecroppers in the South, how she served children in the Black Panther Party's free breakfast program, and eventually became Angela Davis' teaching assistant at UCLA in the 60s. So this is a film about women leaders, it's about my mother, and it's about people who really imagined a better way to live.
So that was Damani Baker there, himself speaking about the purpose of this film. And I think what's special about this documentary, and also quite unique, is that it offers, as well as being a political film, it offers an intimate look at Damani's personal life. What do you make of this sort of aspect of the film? Was it important?
Oh, very much so. I mean, it sort of falls into that kind of who do you think you are, that kind of the TV series where people look back into their roots. So it starts out as Damani Baker looking back and trying to figure out how on earth his family got here from there. So, you know, his great-grandmother was part of a sharecropping family in the American South, and there was Great Migration, then civil rights, you know, the advances in civil rights. And he's trying to piece out where he falls in it. How come that he, as a young filmmaker, you know, has the time, the leisure time, and the money to go around the world making movies, and you know,
even the title of the film, The House on Cocoa Road, has a personal touch, doesn't it?
Yes, it's trying to sort of pin down places in the past and to sort of plot a, if you like, a sort of straight line. You know, how do we get here now in this moment, given everything that's gone before us, and given the indifference of white America to our family and our struggles. You know, how do we get through all that to get to where we are today? And you know, the archive footage is very important in sort of nailing down exactly where that family was at those particular times.
I suppose this is a very symbolic message then, Lee, that politics is kind of inseparable to Black African Americans and their life and their struggle to the present day.
Absolutely, deeply intertwined, and we very much live our lives vicariously through those politics. But I think it's also an interesting narrative on the phenomenon of migration in the modern world, and how those migratory tales can be best be told by the sort of intimate portrait of an individual or group of individuals who are seeking to make a better life for themselves and often escape, you know, horrendous and circumstances. So I think it speaks to that broader narrative. And within that, there's the African diaspora, which scattered across the four ends of the earth, is in a perpetual search for its own identity, its own place in the world, and very much the stepping stones from Africa to the West are seen as important steps along that story.
And that reminds me, actually, of what you were saying of the main protagonist in this documentary, Damani Baker's mother.
Yeah.
What did you make of her contribution, Mike?
It's very important that, actually, the bulk of the voices that you hear in this documentary are female. So it's Fanny, it's her friends and her neighbours in Grenada. It's about women trying to make a life for themselves and trying to raise a family. And it's also, the film itself is the work of a son trying to pay tribute to a mother who raised him right. And I think that's why it's so emotional and so affecting at the end of the day.
I'd like to ask Sister Angela to make a few brief introductory remarks.
I'm here in Free Grenada for the very first time. The experiences that I've had here in Grenada have confirmed in a very powerful way where we are headed, what the future of the entire planet ought to look like. This beautiful, powerful, militant revolution.
My sister Fania and I were so excited by what we saw. We were so struck by the enthusiasm of the not only the leaders, but the everyday people. For us, Grenada, especially for black people, really marked a new moment in history.
It just sort of captured the imagination of us. Here's a socialist government, a revolutionary government right here in our own hemisphere.
This is legendary activist Angela Davis, world-renowned scholar and activist and was a member of the Black Panther Party. Now, Lee, in the film, Grenada was described by black people as being a sort of utopia for black people. And Maurice Bishop, the prime minister at the time, he was tragically later shot dead, said, if we have 95% of predominantly African origin in our country, then we can have a dangerous appeal to 30 million black people in the United States. So why was there such a longing from African Americans for sort of this, a strong black community and leadership?
I think very much African Americans had, coming out of the Vietnam War, were beginning to reassess their place in society. They'd taken part in the Olympics, they'd fought in world wars, and yet they were still facing the most horrendous police brutality and economic discrimination in the land of the home of the free and the land of the brave. Mm-hmm. And I think they began to fundamentally reassess, or at least some did, reassess the extent to which they could prosper in such societies. And as all African diasporas do, they looked to elsewhere in the world where their fortunes might be greater. And of course, there's a deep longing and sort of Garveyan sense of the Jamaican leader Marcus Garvey to build black nation, to build an example of how humanity can work together in a progressive way. And very much the ideals of Cuba and the Grenada revolutionary movement encapsulated for very many black diasporans, African diasporans, their desire to see black nationhood, to see progressive socialism encapsulated and led by, you know, not just Cuba, but joined in by other islands in and around the Caribbean. And as such, it elevated itself into a international country of appeal, where the revolutionary movement put out a worldwide appeal for Africans in the diaspora to come help rebuild Grenada and be part of that movement. And lots of people from the United Kingdom, from the United States, other parts of the world responded to that call.
That's very revealing indeed. I don't think many people know about this aspect of Grenada from the black perspective.
Yeah.
And just speaking of that, Mike, I think also what's invaluable of Baker's documentaries, this archive material he has that juxtaposes sort of the propaganda and he touches on the role of the media. Mm-hmm. What is life like? How was life painted for black people in Grenada, the reality of it?
Well, I mean, this is one of the important facets of this particular film. You get a sense of a place that is trying to, I think the phrase that Maurice Bishop uses, to throw off the Coca-Cola mentality and you know, go in a different direction. And so you do get the footage that we get here that was taken by Damani Baker's own family is very much from the ground up. You're seeing, you know, a kind of grassroots movement building. You know, you're seeing people, you know, taking control of their own destinies in a way that clearly threatened the Reagan administration, and you get this sort of strange sort of contrast between Angela Davis and that particular way of thinking and the Ronald Reagan way of thinking, which, you know, is a little, shall we say, slightly more fearful.
Yes.
Resonates a lot with today, of course.
I think so. And, you know, those contrasts, yes, do have a resonance in what's going on in America today with the way certain white leaders are espousing their values.
We're not naming any names.
Not naming any names, no.
Well, we'll have to move swiftly on just for now.
Ronald Reagan do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
That I will faithfully execute the office of President of the United States.
All of a sudden, the drugs came in so heavy, it was scary, but it destroyed the entire city of Oakland. I mean, there's a discussion now where that came from. Entire black communities were destroyed. With all of my efforts to put you in a good school and try to balance it, there was still, we could sit on that hill in East Oakland and hear gunfire all down the hill all night. It was very disappointing to see all the work that we've done being overrun by drugs. It was not a happy time in the black community anywhere in the States. That was not an environment to raise children.
A little bit more of Angela Davis then. We talked a little bit about her, but I'd like to talk about her a little bit more just before we end the show. And Mike, what do you make of her contribution to this documentary?
It's very important. I mean, she turns up very early on in the film because Fanny DeMonte Baker's mother was a student of hers at the
UCLA,
yes, and later became her assistant. So it's almost about the role of mentoring in American life and how having a good mentor can, you know, change the way you think about the world, change the way you perceive the world. And I think Angela Davis becomes almost Fanny's mentor, you know, and takes her to protests and leads her into a more engaged way of thinking about the world.
And the documentary sheds light on her fair share of struggle, Angela Davis, in her life for racial equality. What does she mean for black activists everywhere?
Hugely symbolic figure for black activists worldwide. Continues to be an inspiration today for the millennials who you see in the Black Lives Matter movement and wider. African women on the continent still revere Angela Davis. She's held in extraordinarily high regard right across the world. And quite rightly so, when you think about the radical stance that she took, putting herself in danger, risking jail, risking a loss of her life, all for the principled struggle for justice and equality. Angela Davis, you know, remains a very sort of bright, burning firmament on the skyline, and she will be revered, I think, for a long time to come.
And what I found inspiring, actually, from this documentary was watching her leadership and how the black unions at the time in the 80s organized. Do you think movements today can learn a lot about that era?
Well, we look at the post-Weinstein movement and the Me Too movement, and we realise just how far we've got to come. People have to realise, when Angela Davis was doing what she was doing, we were talking about 1970s, late 60s America, where the kind of super black machismo was still very much of the sort of shaft. You know, militant young black man was still the focus of the struggle. And along comes Angela Davis, and in one stroke, recenters that struggle, putting black women at the heart of that movement. It was revolutionary at the time, and when you look back on it, you have to appreciate just how significant it really was.
And Mike, we're running towards the end of the show now. I just wanted to get your final thoughts on this film, and would you recommend it?
Oh, very much so. I mean, I found it, you know, inspirational. I found it very engaging. I also found it very educational. I mean, I've not seen much cinematic treatment of the events in Grenada. So to have a first-hand perspective, to have people who are actually on the ground at the time telling the story in their own words, in this very laid-back, you know, very informal way, it was an education for me.
And Lee, if I could turn to you, your final thoughts, and would you recommend this film?
Definitely recommend the film. I think that anything that captures that sort of historical narrative from the victim perspective is going to offer really unique insights for people, and also for people to get a real appreciation of how important globally the Grenadian Revolution was to Africans right across the world.
Well, thank you very much, gentlemen. I wish we could talk more, but we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you again to both my guests and to you. I've been Camelia Shambayati.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Limelight.
Omar Ashmawi, the staff director of the Office of Congressional Ethics, says lack of cooperation has not prevented his office's investigations from moving forward. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Luke Broadwater. The piece is titled Ethics Investigators in Congress Increasingly Run into Walls. Ethics investigators were examining four cases this fall detailing a sweeping array of improper financial conduct by lawmakers. They ran into an obstacle. Two of the lawmakers under scrutiny refused to meet with them or provide documents. The investigators were not too surprised. Over the past decade, fewer and fewer House of Representative members have been willing to cooperate with congressional investigations. A development that ethics experts warn could reduce accountability for misdeeds and erode trust in the institution of Congress. Omar Ashmawi, the staff director of the Office for Congressional Ethics, OCE, an independent entity that reviews allegations against House members and refers misconduct cases to the House Ethics Committee, acknowledged the growing resistance to his office's work, but said he was undeterred. It has never prevented us from being able to gather the facts and determine what happened and whether or not the subject was culpable. Still, the trend is unmistakable. In 2009 and 2010, the first Congress scrutinized by the Office of Congressional Ethics, which was